Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with The Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. With the Cubs and Reds about to thrill the nation with the second annual Field of Dreams game in beautiful Dyersville, Iowa. Actor comedian Mike Pusateri joins me, and we are going to do a movie deep dive of, coincidentally, the movie Field of Dreams. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing good. You know, it's this should really be called the Ricketts Family Field of Dreams, because they could field a great team and not have to pay anybody.
Yeah. Ooh, can't we get some dead guys to come up, crawl out of the cornfield and play for us for nothing?
For free? Like, well, yeah. You know that's what they'd want to do.
Maybe that's what they did. I mean, maybe that's where they got Anderson Simmons and Jonathan VR.
Right.
They just wandered in out of a cornfield.
Yes.
So the we learned in the Carter Hawkins interview with Cole Wright a couple of weeks ago that the Cubs are flying in on Thursday for the Field of Dreams game and then flying home Thursday night. They are spending the bare minimum amount of time in the state of Iowa, which honestly I don't really blame them.
Yeah, can understand that.
Although I do think it will be funny when they go to get on the plane in Dubuque or wherever they fly into, and they're like, Frank. Not so
Frank, why don't you hang back here for a minute?
We got a golf cart here that's going to take you to Des Moines.
Yeah. David Bodie's driving that golf cart. Why don't you stop in next to him? And you guys can enjoy yourselves here in Iowa. Yeah.
Well, that's more hopeful. Me being hopeful than anything. That,
yes.
We're about to end the Frank Schwindel experience, but who knows?
Right. So our goal today will be to make this podcast about the movie more entertaining than the game.
Yeah, that'll be tough.
Shouldn't be that hard, but we'll see.
So as always, you can enjoy the Pointless Exercise podcast and the newsletter at pointlessexercise.com. You can also buy a lovely t-shirt or two if you want. And Mike, how can people out there in the podcast world see what you're up to?
Hit me up on Twitter at Mike Pusateri and on Instagram at I am Mike Pusateri.
Okay, so the movie Field of Dreams was released in 1989, based loosely on a book, Shoeless Joe, by the writer W.P. Kinsella, and adapted into a screenplay by the director of the movie, Phil Alden Robinson.
Right.
Let's see. Phil Alden Robinson, best known otherwise probably for, well, this is the movie he's best known for. He also directed Sneakers. He directed The Sum of All Fears with Ben Affleck. And during the filming of The Sum of All Fears, Ben told Phil, I've already been in one of your movies.
That's right.
In the Fenway Park scene, two of the extras just sitting in the stands, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon.
Their first film. Yes. They're uncredited. Yes. Yes. And did you know that Field of Dreams has been confirmed to be adapted into a Peacock TV show? Did you know that?
Oh, I saw that they hired Mike Schur to,
yes,
to create it, and that they've Parks since told him, we're not doing that.
Oh, well, then you're up more to date than I am.
Literally, I just read like that last night. That he's they're now shopping it looking for a new...
Okay. Yeah. Whoops.
I could be wrong, but it sounds like he...
Well, my information is pre-last night, so I didn't know there was breaking news on this topic.
I saw in one of the as I was looking up all these facts, it was one of the
things. Ah.
So how many Oscars was Field of Dreams nominated for?
I would hope none.
It was nominated for 3.
3.
It was nominated for Best Picture. It was the only Best Picture nominee that none of the actors or the director were nominated.
That's unusual.
It was also nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay.
Okay, I'll give you that.
And for Best Original Score by James Horner.
Give you the score.
It is a good score.
The score I'll give you. I'll give you the score. I haven't seen this movie in I don't know how many years. And before I started rewatching it, I thought, okay, I had in my mind, this is a good 2.5 hour movie. It's only 1 hour and 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. It's actually pretty quick because you think of all the things that happen in this movie, you know, and you're like, oh, this is definitely going to be a couple 2.5 hours of my life easy, but it moves along.
Yeah, it's not on my list of greatest baseball movies.
Right.
I think it's an enjoyable movie.
Yeah.
And we'll get to, I've been there multiple times. I've been to.
Oh, you have?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's a good movie, and it's on a rewatch. It's surprisingly funny.
Yeah.
Like there are, and it's obviously, I mean, it has Kevin Costner and James Earl Jones and Gordon Whitmire and, Timothy Busfield.
Right.
And it's well acted too. Burt Lancaster's in it, for God's sakes.
Absolutely.
So it's James a good movie. I've never understood though that it, apparently the grown men that it makes cry.
You did not shed a tear rewatching it?
I don't get it.
Okay.
I mean I literally have played catch with my dad on the same place Dwyer Brown and Kevin Costner played catch, and it was fun. Yeah. It was cool. Didn't start weeping. He's now dead, and I still watched those two guys play catch and didn't want to cry.
I think the music has a lot to do with it. The music is very touching in that moment.
Yeah, I guess.
If the music wasn't playing when you guys were playing catch on the field, then I could see
why. Or it could very well be that, and we can talk to this as we get to the end, but it's more funny to watch Dwyer Brown try to throw a baseball and try to catch one with the old-time catcher's mitt.
Yeah.
Which I also would struggle with. I'm not making fun of him for having a hard time catching the ball because it's a fucking pillow. That's all they hand him.
Yeah, those things are not very flexible.
Yeah. But he's he doesn't look real. And we might as well get to it. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
He may have been emotional because... What do you think he was doing merely days before he filmed his scenes in Field of Dreams?
He was got me.
Burying his father.
Oh my goodness!
They actually had to delay that scene because Dwyer waiting for the funeral to get to wrap up. So
yikes.
I'm sure it was a little more poignant for Dwyer than it was for me watching.
I'm sure so. I'm sure it was. Yeah.
Yeah, we went when I can't remember if I told this whole fucking story on Remember This Crap. I hope I didn't. But if I did, people can hear it again. When I was a senior in high school, Mom and Dad decided, hey, we're going on one more family trip before you leave the house. My brother and sister were both long gone, so it was just me.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided we were going to Mount Rushmore.
Okay.
Oh, great. It was like, I remember we had to time it so I would get back in time for the start of football practice. So, This was August, early August, about now.
Ooh. All right, all right.
Corn's up. That was part of why Dad wanted to go. We were on our way to South Dakota, but we were going through Dyersville on the way.
Okay.
Because he wanted to go to Field Dreams. So did I. It was fun.
Yeah.
So we hopped in the car. Dyersville is less than 2 hours from here. It's about a half hour from Dubuque. And you drive out in the middle, you know, it's in the middle of nowhere on purpose.
Right.
And you start to come up the road that you kind of feel like you recognize from all the headlights at the end of the
movie
and stuff.
Right, the winding road, yes.
And then there it is. There's just you see the house with the porch swing and you know you're there, and obviously you see the field.
Did you have to pay $20?
It's free, but they accept donations.
Ah, okay, very good.
Yes, I guess they want people to just want to give them $20 without even thinking about it.
Is that a suggested donation? Does it suggest
$20? I don't think it does. I think there's just a big box and you stuff money in it. And that was that was 31 years ago.
Okay.
So 32 years ago. So who knows what it costs now, especially
if
the Ricketts have given them some tips.
Yeah.
Do you guys, if you made this a federal landmark? No. Well, how about, have you buried anybody under the field? Because that'll get you, you won't pay income tax on any of this money.
You know, have you attached a sports book to this field? We could do that.
Maybe they're just going to bury Frank Schwindel alive under first base.
See? And then build a sports book over him.
So then we went there. There were probably 70 or 80 people there.
Okay. So this is an August weekday, basically, or like a Tuesday or something. Okay. Yep.
And Dad and I went out. We played catch. Mom stared at us like, why are we standing in the middle of a baseball field in a cornfield?
And you're like, you know, we're going to go stare at some rocks.
And then you go in the house, is unsurprisingly a gift shop. So we went into the gift shop and bought some crap. Mm-hmm. And then piled in the car and went on our way to South Dakota. And as we were getting closer and closer to wherever Mount Rushmore is, Sioux Falls.
Sioux Falls, South Dakota, I think, yeah.
Well, you see the Wall Drug signs everywhere.
Yeah.
How many miles you are from Wall Drug.
I remember that on my trip to Mount Rushmore
And you see some Burma Shave signs.
Oh, yes.
But you also, there were a lot of motorcycles. Just seeing all these Harleys. As we're driving, there's Harleys.
Oh, was it Sturgis time?
Yeah, it turns out it was the 50th anniversary
of
Sturgis.
Okay.
And this wasn't the days when, you know, you didn't hop online and, like, book your hotels and stuff. That's just going to figure that out when you get there.
Yeah, you look for the vacancy with the note that is not lit up. And then you're like, oh, cool, we could stay here. It's 11:30 at night. Great.
So we go to the national park where it is. And it's even set up so that, like, you park and then there's kind of – you go up this hill to kind of try to create then as you get towards the top of the hill the grand reveal – because you do see it coming in, but you don't get like a front look at Mount Rushmore. So we're coming up, and I'm like 17, and I'm like, oh, just shoot me. Can we just see the fucking rock and go home?
Right.
And we go up there, and I see all these people taking pictures, but they're not taking pictures of Mount Rushmore. They're aiming much lower. Well, it turns out one of the bikers is standing there shirtless with his back to them, and he's holding his arms out. And he has this elaborate American eagle tattooed on his back with the wings going up each arm. And that's what they're taking pictures of.
Okay.
We saw Mount Rushmore, and there really is some cool stuff with, what's his name? Borglund. Gustav Borglund? Anyway, the crazy German that they hired to shove dynamite in the side of the mountain and blow it up to make it look like four dudes.
Right.
And it is pretty interesting to see how they did it and how long it took and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then you're just kind of, that was 4 hours. Now what do we do? We're in the middle of South Dakota. We went to you can go see Crazy Horse, not Neil Young's band. You can actually see Crazy Horse. There's a monument.
Yeah, I've done that.
Another hill.
I've done that.
And we went to Wall Drug. And I don't remember what else we did. Oh, I know we went to the Black Hills, and we also went to some horrible tourist trap where you got to see a bunch of baby bears. It's very cute.
Did you go to Deadwood while you were out there? Isn't that out there somewhere?
Oh, probably.
I don't even know.
I don't know if we did or not.
I feel like when I went, we went to like a cowboy cookout or something. That was exciting.
So then we stayed a couple of days and then back in the car and on our way. And on our way back, we hit Dyersville again because it was on. Dad was like, hey, you want to go again?
Yeah.
He basically was like, we got to get out of the car and stretch somewhere. We'll go play catch. So we did. We played catch again. And then a couple of years later, when I was in college, I took my friend Neil. He's a Sox fan and wanted to go, maybe see if Shoeless Joe would come wandering in out of the corn. And we drove out there and went. That was a much different experience because I was not nearly as hungover when I played catch with Dad as I was when I played catch with Neil. Pretty sure we were drunk while we were there because we hit a couple of taverns in between Dubuque and Dyersville. I don't remember where we went. Much different experience that time. So I've been there three times, and I'm probably not going back.
Okay.
Had my
not going for the big game this week? You're going to save your. I imagine tickets are a bit higher than $20.
Yeah, Crawley's gone. Big shock.
Yeah, so Crawley's gone.
Sucker. The Cubs can sucker him into anything. what do you say? He's paying like $400 for his tickets, something like that.
And I think that's a deal, right? It's like some kind of deal he got. Aren't they going for like $800 minimum or some crazy amount?
I don't understand the Major League Baseball rewarding the Cubs with the Field of Dreams game this year and the London game next year. It's like you're making it very easy for them to not bother to try to contend if you keep giving them these, pardon the pun, marquee events. It's like, how about you tell them, look, we're not giving you an All-Star game, and we're not giving you a Field of Dreams, and we're not giving you the London thing until you actually put a good team on the field. Because
you're ruining
our showcase events.
You're right, of course, but you know why? It's because of us. It's because the Cubs have an enormous fan base, a rabid fan base, and they'll know that we'll bring it'll bring ratings. Just like last year, when why are the Yankees playing the White Sox? Because that made no sense. But nobody's going to watch White Sox Red, so they got to get people that teams care about to play them to watch the game.
Year one of this was supposed to be Cardinals White Sox, right?
Yeah, I think
COVID.
So, yeah.
Then they were still holding out hope they were going to do it, which was ridiculous. We had an empty Field of Dreams game, and it was that's when the Yankees kind of slid in. They were going to replace the Cardinals. And then when they did it last year for real, they left the Yankees as the opponent. This year the Reds actually have a more relevant connection to this game than the Cubs do, considering
of course, they're the other team.
They were the team in the 1919 World Series that the Sox threw. Which is why those eight dudes were hanging out in the corn in the first place.
Right.
But, I mean, we joked about it last year, about what a terrible game it was going to be, because the Cubs were tearing down, the Reds weren't any good, and then the Reds went and they tore down even further immediately in the offseason, like just handing Wade Miley over to the Cubs and trading everybody away. And now you've got two of the, four worst records in the National League.
Horrible.
Squaring off in this game.
Yeah.
And I guess if you're Fox, you're like, it doesn't matter who's playing because
it's
even better for them that it's two non-contending teams, because now when they do all the hokey in-game shit,
nobody's going
to
care.
There are no fans who are like, we're trying to win a game here.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Maybe that's what they want. Maybe it's, next year it'll be the, I don't even know who's not trying to win. I was going to say the Orioles, but the Orioles are actually above 500, so I can't even use them as an example.
Just
might as well be the Cubs and the Reds again next year.
Yeah. But this is going to be interesting too. Like, do you think Kevin Costner is going to show up this year like he did last year?
I was thinking, who do you get for year two?
Yeah, I can't imagine he's coming.
Do you get Frank Whaley instead?
You get Frank. Frank would be great.
Is he the one who comes?
Timothy Busfield maybe will show up.
It could be Timothy Busfield.
Yeah.
In fact, if Timothy Busfield came, then they should have invited Pete Crow Armstrong so that his mom would have come.
Right.
Because shouldn't she date Timothy Busfield in Little Big League?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I think so. So
there's a direct connection there.
Well, maybe Gabby Hoffman could come because she's in Winning Time.
I'm sure we get to the cast, but I would much rather see Gabby at a Uncle Buck themed.
Oh, that would be outstanding.
She had quite a 1989.
Yeah.
6-year-old Gabby Hoffman had a big year.
Amy Madigan, by the way, in both of these movies too.
Right.
Big Amy Madigan year.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a, when we get to the, who was the voice? There's a theory as to who it is because there's an Amy Madigan connection.
Well, I know the theory.
Yeah.
I wonder if most people do. Go ahead and submit your answers.
Yeah, tweet that over to us.
Who do you think is the voice? And we'll get to that at some point.
All right, so we might as well start to plow through this movie. So at the very beginning, what other movie did we do that did the credits this way? Did Goodfellas, right? Where you just have a black screen and the names. Although in Goodfellas, didn't it cut a couple of times to the car?
Yes, it did.
Where this doesn't do anything.
No.
You just sit in the theater and look at huge names, and then you get a little you get a little Kevin Costner voiceover montage.
Right, and Goodfellas too, you had the car sound like, you know, a name would pop up.
Oh, yeah.
Like that.
It would go by.
Yeah, slide off.
So I had a problem with this movie right away with his voiceover.
Okay.
And it's that the math is really weird. So he basically, it does a good job. He basically summarizes his childhood in, I don't know, 4 minutes.
Yeah.
Breathe.
His entire life's journey, how he got here, his problems with his father, how he ended up on a farm, all those things.
He says here that his dad was born in North Dakota in 1896, and that he went to the service, and then he played in the minors for a year or two. I would think that would be a fact you would know. You would have
you
that
would
nailed
that.
Down to one or two.
It's like you always point out the Prevagen commercials. Yes. I've been taking it for 3 to 5 years. Like, it's a memory drug. You should probably know if it was 3 or 5 or 4 or what it is.
Then he said dad moved to Brooklyn in 1935. And he married mom in 1938.
Okay.
Okay, so 1935, that means dad is 39
okay.
when he marries mom, which is fine. That can happen.
Sure.
He said he was an old man working in the Navy Yards when Ray was born. 1952. So dad is 56 years old when Ray is born.
Okay.
So 14 years after they got married, they had a kid. So are we thinking right. that we've got like a Dane Cook situation here with dad and the same mom was 20. So
yeah.
She's 34. That's fine. You can have a baby. My mom was 33 when she had me. She thought she was ancient.
Mm-hmm.
She cried when she found out she was pregnant with me because she was too old to have a baby. She was 33.
Okay,
so he's 56 when Ray is born.
Okay.
Mom dies when Ray is 3.
When Ray's 3, okay.
He dies in 1955.
Right. Okay.
And then here's the first thing I chuckled as, you know, when you watch the movie the first time, you're not really paying attention. You're basically looking at the pictures and you hear, oh, mom died, dad raised him. But
what
you hear is, dad was a Yankees fan, so Ray rooted for Brooklyn. Dodgers moved to L.A. in 1958 when Ray was 6. So that means a 4 or 5 year old Ray was such an asshole, he picked a team other than his dad's.
Right.
I mean, this maybe if you're 12, you knew it to be a prick. He was 4, basically.
He's like,
I like the Dodgers.
He doesn't have any consciousness of any memory at 4, I wouldn't think. So certainly not enough to be like a dick about it,
The Dodgers' last season in Brooklyn was 57.
Yeah, there's no way.
He's 5 years old when they leave, but he's a huge... Yeah. And then it says, we had to find other things to argue about. They were literally having arguments when he was 5 years old about baseball, and they had to find something else to argue about.
On his 3rd birthday, they were arguing Dodgers-Yankees.
Yeah. Another thing I loved was he said when he went to college, he picked a college as far away as he physically could. So he went to Cal Berkeley.
Yep.
And he said, officially, my major was English, but really, it was the 60s.
It was the 60s.
Okay. I have another. So how old is he when he goes, let's say he's 17. Let's say he's young.
Okay.
He goes to college in 1969.
Right.
He didn't live the 60s. He lived 1 year. He lived the 60s in California.
Right.
He went in August. He 4 months.
He had four months of
the 60s in California.
Well, maybe he meant he was a history major, and that's what it was. He was studying the past.
But in Berkeley, he met Annie.
Right.
The only thing they had in common was that she was from Iowa, and he'd heard of Iowa.
Yeah.
And then I thought this was actually funny. After graduation, we went to the Midwest, and we stayed with her family as long as we could, almost a full afternoon.
That was good. I liked that. I chuckled at that, too. That was good.
So... Annie and Ray got married in June 1974. Because he.
By the way, we meet that family, so we know where he's coming from. But...
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And I also noticed that. So they show the picture, the very Whistler's. Is that Whistler's daughter? What's the famous photo?
Oh yeah. With the farmer and the
American Gothic.
American Gothic.
They basically reenact that pose. They even have the old bald guy. The mom, then, they don't even age up later when she's grandma. She just looks exactly the same.
Right.
Makeup budget was not extensive, apparently. This is not a Martin Scorsese Netflix movie. They're not spending a lot of money on the aging. Mm-hmm. They get married in 74. So that means Ray was 22. Dad died that fall. So he would have been 78.
So Dad had a long life.
So then it says a few years later, Karen was born.
Mm-hmm.
So Gabby Hoffman was 6 in 1988, which is when they filmed this.
Right.
And she made both Field of Dreams and Uncle Buck. So that means that it was 8 years after they got married that they had Karen. So now we've got a timeline, which to me clearly meant they stuck with the timeline in the book, even though the movie is set far later than the book was.
Right.
So
right.
Couldn't you have simply, do you think the Dodgers thing, it shouldn't have fucked him up because they made Dad so old.
Yeah.
Like, if he's born in, like, 1930 instead of 1896, this whole thing makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, it does.
Because he's going to complain about Dad seeming like he was old. Well, I got news for you, Ray. He was.
Yeah. Right.
He was raising your whiny ass in his 60s.
Yeah. And especially in that era, too. You know, 40 years ago, when people were 60, that's like, wow, there's a lot.
Well, that's what I was saying. My mom had my brother and my sister when she was 23 and 24.
Yeah.
And then I come waltzing along at 33, and she was convinced she was too old to have a baby.
Right.
And I even remember thinking that I had, like, that I had older parents than my friends, and I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
The only difference was I had an older brother and sister than my friends did. But most of my friends, their parents were, you know, 28, 29, or 30 when they had them. Mom
Same
was 33.
Age.
That's not that.
Yeah, close enough. You can't tell the difference at that age. Yeah.
So anyway, so these two hippies from California who hated their one afternoon in Iowa so much buy Annie's parents' farm.
Yeah. That was a little odd choice, but okay.
So the first real shot of the movie is this iconic shot at sunset of Kevin Costner walking through the cornfield. The corn is shoulder high, a little higher, which to me means it's probably July.
Mm-hmm,
there's the old knee high by the 4th of July. Have you heard that thing for corn?
Yeah, well, that's the only thing, because I grew up in the city, so that's the only thing I knew was knee high by the 4th of July.
If it's 4th of July and your corn is knee high, you're fucked.
Oh, that's bad.
Yeah,
that's a bad thing.
It rhymed. It was in Oklahoma. No, it's corn as high as an elephant's eye. But knee high by the 4th of July. Maybe that was a thing in like the 20s.
The 1820s?
Yeah, but no, it needs to be taller. So it's shoulder high, so it's July. Plus, we know actually from the filming that it really was July. We also know that, and I've talked about this on Remember This Crap, 1988 was a horrible drought. Horrible.
Ah, right.
And they had to basically truck in water from the Mississippi to keep the movie corn alive.
Mm.
And the guy who owned the farm got all kinds of shit from his neighbors. They were pissed because their corn is dying, you know, in the field, curling
right
up.
Right, right.
And he's got a bunch of Hollywood assholes out there spraying water to grow to make sure his corn grows.
Well, I think all those people that must have appeared as extras in the movie, because the Iowa townsfolk do not like...
there's two scenes where they show up and they're not happy. Three, where they're not happy.
They are not happy with Kevin Costner. Oh, no.
So anyway, so he's wandering through the corn, and you hear...
Which is, again, now for me, I hadn't watched this movie in I don't know how many years, a dozen, 20, maybe more. And I was kind of like, you know, I give them credit. They got right to it. Mm-hmm. They get right to it. I like that. There's no fucking around. Yep. It's like, boom, he's in the cornfield. If you build it, they will come. We're right into it.
So he yells out to the porch. Fanny can hear it. And her and Karen are sitting on the porch swing.
Yeah.
Which I've sat. Everybody who's ever been to that place has sat in that porch swing. I had a picture taken in it. I had me too.
Right.
And they can't. And he's wandering around. He still hear it. And so then they call him in for dinner. That's another problem I have several times with this movie.
Okay.
Okay, so it's sunset, and the reason in the movie it's sunset is it's pretty.
Right.
You're in Iowa in July. It's 9:30 at night if the sun is setting.
It's bedtime for the daughter. It's
you got a 6-year-old kid and you're not feeding her dinner until 9:30. You really are dirty hippies from California. So anyway, so he comes into the house, and this I didn't get. He's trying to figure out what the voice could have been. And he asks the weirdest question.
Yeah.
He asks Annie, is there like a sound truck on the highway or something? What the fuck is a sound truck?
Why would there be a sound truck on the highway in Iowa? That's a Hollywood thing. Somebody's like, have him ask if there's a sound truck.
A sound truck? That's just the weird. And then maybe kids with a radio? And she's like, no. Well, you don't, I mean. And she asks, are you hearing voices? He says, just one.
Yeah. Right. He also, by the way, did you notice he goes to the fridge, he takes out a gallon of milk or whatever, a carton of milk, and he sniffs it?
Yep.
I was like, you think there's bad milk in there? Ray, what's going on? What are you feeding your daughter that you got spoiled milk in the
fridge? Three people in Iowa with a quart of milk, and he's got to check to see if it went bad.
Yeah.
Lay off the doobie.
This is why you're listening to the podcast, folks. These are the details that we bring to light and discuss.
Imagine if he didn't like the movie, what kind of. At one point, she wakes up and he's sitting in the window looking at the corn, I think. And she's like, Ray, and he's like, it's okay, honey, I'm just talking to the cornfield.
Yeah.
Just kind
of. That's funny.
So the next morning, he gets up and Karen, his daughter, is doing what all kids do, sitting at the kitchen table watching an old Jimmy Stewart movie.
Yeah.
She's watching Harvey.
As all 6-year-olds are wont to do.
So,
Dad, is Harvey on?
Dad? So, Dad, you've been hearing voices. How about I want to watch the Jimmy Stewart classic with the imaginary rabbit.
Yeah.
Now, apparently, the reason that was in the screenplay was they originally approached Jimmy Stewart about playing Doc Graham. And then that would have brought it like full circle.
Ah, okay, very nice.
He said he was no longer. He'd be like asking Gene Hackman now.
Gotcha.
And he's like, "Fuck off! I'm in Santa Fe painting. I'm not acting anymore.
Go I'm back. Out. I'm out. Right. Okay. Well, they couldn't have done better than Bert. Bert was outstanding.
So Ray wants to take Karen to school because he's going to the. I don't know if he's going to the co-op or the feed store, but he's going somewhere. So he's going to take her. And he goes in there, and there's a bunch of grumpy farmers in there.
Very grumpy.
And the thing I noticed about it was they're all wearing, like, brand new seed corn hats. A lot of Kent, maybe some Rinks, but there's a lot of Kent seed corn hats fresh out of the box. The one guy he talks to very clearly at some point, they're like, shit, we need to make this hat dirty. They just, like, you could tell. They just kind of, like, somebody took a hand and just, like, rubbed a little dirt on it to make it look used.
Rub some dirt on it. Right.
But he asked the thing that any sensible person would ask. He's like, do farmers hear voices in the field? He's like, you're hearing voices? No, I just heard that some farmers do. And of course I don't. And the guy yells, Ray's hearing voices.
Yeah. And the forgiving people of Iowa didn't like hearing that from this weirdo, this hippie weirdo.
I thought of us immediately when I asked, did you see what he bought at the co-op? He bought two things.
He buys the whatever that thing is.
He buys a like a 20-pound bag of quality seed.
Yeah,
which makes no sense in July. It's not feed. Apparently they got you hear a rooster once, so apparently they have chickens.
Okay,
but feed. It's like seed. You're not planting anything. One bag's not going to do you any good, and you're not planting anything in July. So I don't get why. It's clearly a prop. But
okay,
he
that
also
went,
buys
that went right over my head. Right over my head. Okay.
But he also buys some 3-in-1 oil. But he does not buy gauze pads or ball bearings. So clearly, it's not all ball bearings these days.
It's not
in Iowa.
Norris Spitters jackknifed on the Santa Ana.
Whee!
I didn't put that one together either. See, that's outstanding.
So now he's back out in the field. He's a farmer, outstanding in his field.
With his new bag of seed that he can't plant.
And I do wish Dad was around to ask him what he thinks he's doing here.
Okay.
Even the first time we see him, he's out in the field with a shovel. He's back right. with the shovel, and he digs up one plant, and he turns it over, and he looks at the roots.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what he could possibly be looking at. He's got clearly a healthy corn crop, so if he's worried that there's, you know, he's got boll weevils or anything, in the, it's too late.
Yeah.
So he basically just digs one up for nothing.
Okay.
It's just, maybe it's to just set the, set it up that we know he's a shitty farmer. He's just bad. Because I don't know what he's doing out there, and I don't know what he's doing.
Right, right. Well, that is a recurring theme. They're always telling him what a bad farmer he is.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So he hears the voice again.
Okay.
And this time he argues with it, and then he has a vision.
Right.
He sees in the cornfield, he sees a baseball diamond with the silhouette of a man standing at about second base.
Yes.
And then we see... And I think he sees, too, we see Ray Liotta.
Yes, that's right.
So maybe it's supposed to be Joe Jackson. I don't know. Maybe it's just Ray. He's like, ooh, I have a movie star in my yard. Goes back in the house, and he's trying to explain to his wife that he thinks he's supposed to dig up his corn crop and build a baseball field. And Shoeless Joe Jackson will get to come back and play ball again. And she does not start throwing things at him, which it takes me completely out of the movie.
Yeah, that's a little bit odd, too.
She's a little too accepting.
Yeah, absolutely.
But she does have a good line.
Hey, you don't suppose this is like acid flashback or anything, do you?
I never took acid.
Well, maybe it will someday. It's like a flash forward.
Yeah, that's good.
That was funny. So he tells her the Babe Ruth pattern to swing after Joe, and that if he built the field...
He's telling this to Karen, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well,
about Babe Ruth. He's given the history of... Yes. He's basically given us the history of the of Shoeless Joe and the scandal.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's cutting to different... It's got, maybe it's more of a montage, where sometimes he's talking to Karen, sometimes he's talking to Annie... Because some of the stuff he says, the stuff he wouldn't tell the daughter. Yep, Babe Ruth, and this can right an old wrong. And then I know he says this to Annie. He's like, but he says he's worried he's turning into his father, and he never forgave him for getting old. It's like, no, we've already established.
He was old.
He was old when you were born. You don't get to be mad at him for that. He goes, by the time he was as old as I am now, he was ancient. Well, you don't fucking know, because that was 16 years before you were born, when he was your age.
Right. Exactly. And now I'm sure we're going to get to the fact that Ray Liotta's batting stance.
Yes.
But he mentioned, but you do hear, you know, Babe Ruth copied his swing. Well, Babe Ruth, I think we all know, was a lefty. Yeah. So it'd be kind of, if you're not.
Unfortunately, so was Joe. Just not Ray.
Yes. Right, but you think that might be something that maybe we tweak this line a little bit, or we use another player, we do something else, but no. Why would Babe Ruth copy a right-handed player swing, Dad?
He says, he's talking about his dad, he must have had dreams, but he never did anything about him. Again, he's 52.
We don't know.
By the time you're born, by the time you're three, he's a widower with an annoying, argumentative three-year-old. So
he ain't in the follow your dreams phase of his life at that point. Yeah.
So he thinks building the field is his last chance to do something spontaneous.
Mm-hmm.
And Annie says if he really feels he should do it, he should do it. So apparently she's having acid flashbacks, because I'm sure she did acid, even if he didn't.
Yeah. First of all, it's my only chance to do something spontaneous. Okay. Maybe buy a motorcycle. Like, that's not a great reason to build a baseball field in the middle of your farm. And your point is, she's very accepting about this, because it's clear that they do not have a lot of money. So this is going to be a big fit. It's not like, we're millionaires just kind of farming for fun. Go right ahead.
Well, this sets something up that I think maybe there's a reason she was accepting about it.
Okay.
So we see, they say he's plowing under the corn. He's not. He's actually got, he's chopping it down. He's basically going over it with what looks like a hay mower, and which I guess is what you'd have to do. And then you have to plow under what's left. I would guess by July, there was none of the corn was mature enough to get anything out of, so he probably has to just get rid of it.
But he's got a whole pile of, like, there's like a dozen Iowa townsfolk staring at
him. They're sitting there in their, next to their crappy old 70s cars, which I loved. The fact And these are just, like, people from Dyersville that just drive out.
Oh, clearly.
They may very well have been there just to watch the filming, and they just shot them. Because it would be perfect. They've got lawn chairs. They're...
Yeah. Well, they would have had to inform
them. No, but
them
I mean, they may have gone out there and said...
Yeah, that's, hey, you guys want to be in the movie? Oh, exactly.
This would fit. Yeah. Do you want to be in the movie?
Exactly. Yeah.
What the hell is he doing?
He's found under his corn.
Why?
Because they did do a lot of town involvement in the. A lot of them were extras in the movie, even in scenes that weren't set in Iowa. Okay, so here's where my biggest problem with the movie on the millionth rewatch is this. Do you know how big an acre is?
No.
So an acre is roughly 3/4 of a football field.
Okay.
From the size of that baseball field that he makes, given that there's very little foul territory, there's no grandstand, there's no bullpens, basically the field, a backstop, and one little set of bleachers.
Mm-hmm.
At the most, it's 2 acres.
Okay.
He plowed under 2 acres of corn to make this field.
Not very much, is your point.
I would say that an average-sized small farm in Iowa, which he had, is probably 300 acres.
Huh.
Maybe 200. The farm that the actual Field of Dreams farm is actually, what you see in the movie is two farms. Because there's
two fields.
If you kind of draw a diagonal line through left field, about where Ian Happ will be falling down trying to chase fly balls on Thursday night.
Right.
That starts the neighbor's farm. And really that has more to do with the fact that when they were scouting, they're like, ooh, this is the perfect spot. And they're like, well, it's not 100% in my, you're going to have to go get permission, which became a huge deal then when the one guy who had the house and the farm wanted to make a tourist attraction, and the other guy's like, I didn't want to go back to planting fucking corn on that corner.
Right, right.
The farm that that guy's was 200 acres.
Okay.
But that's a relatively small farm, even for them.
So you're talking, it's 1% or less is how much space this baseball field takes up.
Yeah, so say it's a 300 acre, I guess it doesn't really matter, 200 or 300 acres. At that time, in the 80s, corn, you were getting about 100 bushels to the acre.
Okay.
Corn was selling for about $3 a bushel.
Okay.
He plowed under $600 worth of corn.
Okay.
If he was going bankrupt because of $600 worth of corn, he was fucking going bankrupt anyway.
No matter
what. And you might as well have humored him by letting him build the baseball field because... Yeah. You know, it, and even then, of course, in 1988, there was the drought. It may have been harder on him in 88, but that doesn't really, it factors into real life, but not the movie, because they don't talk about the drought in the movie. Yields were way down. I think I looked it up. The average yield in Iowa that summer was like down to 73 bushels per acre, and prices tanked to about 250. So he was losing even less money. The problem was he was also making less on the other, whether it's 198 acres or 298, whatever he's got above and beyond. But basically, the thing that they hammer over and over again is what an asshole he was for not planting corn on that land. You know,
Not only that, it's a central theme of the movie that him doing this is put his family on the verge of financial ruin.
Yes.
And you've just pointed out, we're talking about $600 here.
He was on the verge of financial ruin anyway.
Yeah, if that were the case. But they tie it repeatedly as to the farm, as of course does Gordon. I mean, Timothy.
At the least, he took 2% of their farmland offline at the most 2%, at the least 1.5%.
Yeah,
I think he's probably it's probably gonna be okay.
Probably okay. Yeah.
Now, so as I was looking this up, I decided, I'm like, why is an acre? Why is that the unit of measure? It seems odd, right?
Yeah. Right.
You're not going to be shocked to know that an acre is a very old way of measuring land, and it was determined by somebody that it's the amount of soil that an ox could plow in a day.
Hmm.
That's an acre. That's what we're still measuring. When you buy a house and you get a half acre, they had to bring an ox out and give him, give him, I don't know, 12 hours. I don't know how many. Well, this is an 8-hour day for the ox? So the ox goes for 4 hours, and whatever he can plow, that's what you get to build the house on? Are they still doing it that way?
Well, I don't know. He's going to get a cigarette break, you would think, the ox, and a coffee break. Yeah, that's okay.
Okay, now, so there are, it's not all, it's not just $600, though, right? Because
there's the cost of building the field.
I mean, he obviously spends money. He builds, and she says he builds a nice field. He does. He builds a very
nice
field.
It's a gorgeous field. It's a gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous field,
Given the fact that it has to be July when he does it, and that the corn is not, so he also pissed away money on sod. He obviously couldn't have seeded that and grown it that fast, so he pissed away money on sod. But by far the dumbest thing he did was he put lights in.
Yes, that's exactly.
Why are there lights? Why do you give it yourself? The lights are expensive, and you've got a power. You got to pay your electric bill is going through the roof.
Yeah.
And
how would you even do that? How would he even get those light towers by himself? Because they really,
Karen might have helped. She's.
Doesn't he have to order? Is he going to have to order those from somewhere?
Maybe
that's going to take.
Stole
like,
them from. Maybe he went down to Dyersville High.
And took their
stole
from
the lights. They went to have their first football game. Like, there's no lights up there. What?
they cut that scene from the movie. Yeah, where is he getting these light towers?
So
and this
I
money?
Do buy
and this,
fact,
and this expertise, by the way, because we've established he majored in the '60s, in the '70s.
Yes.
How does he have an expertise to build up light towers?
So I guess maybe the argument, maybe people were making it to their podcast machines while we were talking. It is sure it maybe only cost him $600 worth of income this 1 year, but how many thousands of dollars did this asshole spend to build the field? And if they had a bad year, which they clearly did, they don't have any savings to dip into to get through the bad year. So that, I guess, but it's never really, it kind of is. She mentions that they don't have savings anymore.
Yeah.
When they're sitting there at the kitchen table. Another weird thing that happens though.
One other weird thing weird thing about the lights is he's building this ostensibly for Shoeless Joe Jackson, who never played under the lights.
In fact, they have a conversation about it.
Yeah, they do. Right. But what makes him think, Shoeless Joe's not going to come unless I build lights?
Is it just because there are lights in the vision?
Right, but I suppose, but why would there?
Is he like using that? Did I become blueprints? Oh, fuck, I got to put lights up.
Yeah, but why did the vision have to have lights? Why couldn't it just been a beautiful baseball field without lights?
Yeah,
okay. Go ahead. You were going to say.
Before we get to that, though. I know what it is. When he's talking to Karen is while they're building the it cuts. At one point, he's loading like chain link into his truck, but another, they're actually hammering nails in to build the bleachers. And he's talking about Joe and the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
And he's given that old White Sox fan bullshit about how he hit 371 in the World Series.
Right.
And he didn't make an error. And he hit the only home run in the series. Like, you don't have to do – you can – so you're saying that by making outs in 62.9% of his at-bats, you could pick your spots. And you can still – you don't have to make an error in the outfield. You can just not get to a ball.
Exactly. You cannot get to a fly ball.
That never absolved. We know the whole – in 8-Men Out, which came out just months before this. So it was a Joe Jackson renaissance. They talk about how Joe was illiterate and he didn't know what he was signing, which also I think is bullshit.
Right.
Charlie Comiskey had fucked all those guys over and this was a way to make some money. And everybody knew they weren't the first team to throw games even in the World Series. There are a lot of thoughts that the year before when the Cubs lost to the Red Sox, the Cubs tanked a couple. Mm-hmm. Same gamblers, just the White Sox got to be more famous.
So anyway, that's the thing too. That yes, he did. Bottom line, he did take the money. That's not a question. He did take the money. He blamed it on Swede, if I believe. He was afraid of Swede Risberg would beat him up, or whatever, or do something worse to him. But bottom line, he did take the money.
Yeah. So I actually said, and my note was, he's explaining he doesn't think Joe threw any games in the World Series. Joe took the money. Fuck him. That was my actual.
That's
fuck Joe Jackson.
I think that's fair.
So then we see Annie and Ray laying on a blanket on their new field with the lights on, burning a little electricity. Why not? And he goes, I have just created something totally illogical. And she goes, that's what I like about it. And he says, am I completely nuts? And she says, not completely.
Yeah, not completely. Yep.
So then, this is also curious. I don't know why we need this. Now we see it's winter and the field is covered in snow.
Yeah.
And he's sitting in a terrible Christmas sweater looking out wistfully onto the field through the window while everyone else is having a Christmas party in his house.
Yes. My guess is that is to ratchet up the fact that he's not making any money. Their financial situation is becoming more dire. The townspeople think he's even crazier because he builds this field and whatever he thought was going to happen doesn't happen. And now it's winter and they should commit this guy, I think.
So then we see Annie and Ray going over their finances at the kitchen table. And she says they can almost break even. And through the window, we can see that the corn is once again head high. So it's now a year later. It's the next July.
Okay.
When do they do their books?
I'm guessing they're doing it at the wrong time.
Just now figuring out that they're running out of money? It's like, I would think you had a crop and a yield in October, and you should have paid all your shit then, and you had to have money to plant this year's crop. I don't think this is a conversation that you're having in July.
Yeah.
But they are.
Okay.
So anyway, Karen is interrupting them, and they're doing the movie thing where they're ignoring the little kid, and she keeps saying it. And then she, finally she gets her attention. She said, there's a man out there on the lawn, which I think
right.
is
funny. Yeah, that's funny.
And so they see that it's Joe, and Annie sees him, which is important. We know Karen saw him, and we know Ray can see him, and Annie sees him, and she says, I'll go put on some coffee. And Ray goes outside to introduce himself.
Right.
And then this is a nice, awkward scene. You know, there's this creepy man standing on this field in an old-timey baseball uniform, but he recognizes him as being Joe Jackson, because when he was a kid, he saw a baseball card. You see that early on in the movie. They see the baseball cards of Babe Ruth and the Ty Cobb, and then
I think it was Ty Cobb,
Joe Jackson, which is Ray Liotta.
Right.
So he introduces himself, and then Joe clearly wants to play. Ray goes, tries to hit him a fly ball, and shanks one, and then finally hits him one.
That was funny. Actually, that was pretty funny. Yeah.
So in real life, Joe Jackson threw right-handed, batted left-handed. In the movie, Ray Liotta throws left-handed and bats right-handed. It seems to me there were two options here. Number one, he's an actor. They could get him to act like he does it the opposite. Or because he does both things backwards, you could do the old Gary Cooper.
Yeah.
You know, where they put number four backwards on his Yankees jersey and had him bat right-handed and then flipped the negative or whatever.
Right.
Because he's backwards in both, it would be relatively easy in any scene that's just him to literally just flip it.
Yeah, Billy Crystal did that in 61 with Whitey Ford. Flipped him, what's his name? Russ. He took Russ and flipped him. He was a righty, made him a lefty. So did you know that Ray Liotta was actually, he was training for a month with, I think it was a USC baseball coach.
Yep.
And he was batting left-handed and throwing right-handed.
Oh, he was?
For a month. Okay. He was. He was working on this for a month. And I guess the directors or the producer, somebody came out, and I guess they weren't thrilled with what they were seeing. And they said, you know what? Because that's, just do it your natural way. Which is how he ended up batting right and throwing left. But he said, before I had looked this up, that's one of the things I always wondered if I ever got to work or meet with Ray Liotta, I wanted to ask him about that. Why did you do that? Or why did you let them talk? You know, how did that happen? And he said that to this day, he said this in an interview when he was alive, obviously, that he regretted it because he regretted doing that because he really wanted to make sure things were accurate. And he hated the fact that he, as he put it, let them talk him into doing it that way. He also had a great line, too, because everybody evidently would always bring that up to him for the rest of his life. That why did you do that? You know, why did you bat right-handed? And he was like, you know, none of the players ever came back to life.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a movie.
Yeah, exactly.
So while they're after he shags a few flies, he wants to hit.
Yes.
And I only noticed this when I watched this the other day. So he goes to the bat bag, and he pulls out a bat. Obviously, it's modern stuff. Thankfully, Ray didn't try to make bats, so they would be era of, appropriate.
Right.
So he pulls out a Louisville Slugger, and he does this whole scene holding this bat. He's kind of staring at it, and he sniffs it at one point. I mean, he really likes this bat. That bat has a huge crack that goes all the way down the bat. You could see it plain as day. It's a broken bat. It goes all the way down.
Oh, man.
And it's, and then in the scene, he takes it to home plate. Joe Jackson doesn't know, can't recognize a broken bat.
He doesn't know. He's not.
Of course, he hits with it, doesn't break because it's the movie. But it's like, you could toss that one, Joe. It's broken.
Yeah. That's amazing that even made it into the prop bag, honestly.
I mean, I noted through the chain link at one point. They shoot it through the fence. You could clearly see that the bat has a big crack in it.
Right.
It runs all the way down, it's down the barrel, all the way down. It disappears down in the handle somewhere.
Yeah.
So you probably know a couple of good things. Oh, first he says, don't we need a catcher?
Yeah, not if you get anywhere near the plate.
So that's good.
That was great.
And there is a shot where Ray Liotta, Joe, lines one back, and it kind of hits Costner right about there. It kind of knocks him off the mound. That apparently really happened. That wasn't supposed to happen. It was Ray actually got a hold of one.
Yeah.
See if you can hit my curve. Yeah, you can hit the curveball.
So I think there's kind of a missed opportunity there. If he actually had gotten to the point where he could hit the ball really well, you don't really see, there's not like a good shot where it's clearly Ray.
Right.
Like they're either from behind or you see him make contact, but then you don't see where the ball goes.
A couple
of them in the montage you can tell aren't going anywhere, but he does, there's one that the way it leaves the bat, you could tell that he really got a hold of one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like when we did Major League, we talked about how they could shoot Dennis Haysbert. They could just let you see Serrano hit the ball because he could hit the baseball so far.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I also wonder if maybe that was a reason, too, that the producers or whatever wanted him to bat. I wonder if there's something about the angle and if, like, him shoot, if everything was going towards left field was better for some technical reason. And maybe that's why they did it. I don't know.
You wouldn't have been able, if you've tried to have him, or if you just tried to flip it, like you try to fake it. Like left hand looks bad, right hand swings pretty good. We're gonna fake it.
Yeah.
Then you wouldn't be able to show Costner pitching to him directly because he would be backwards.
Right, that's for two.
He'd have to pretend he's left handed the whole movie.
But you gotta give both of them a lot of credit when that ball comes back and knocks him down. Because they stayed in the scene, you know, and Kevin Costner gets up, he's like, whoa, but Ray Liotta uses that moment to glare him down, which was really nicely done. It was really well done.
I like the, let's see if he can hit my curve.
He looks like, okay, jerky, whatever. Yeah.
Joe says, I love this game. I'd have played for food money. It was a game. The sounds, the smells, and all I can think of is he really misses the troughs. Misses the smell of the urinal troughs.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure in the teens were really something.
They must have really very sanitary. Great. Yeah.
Whew.
Yeah.
Now, one reason in the movie that the lights paid off was in that scene. And I don't know how many nights they shot, but when they're walking off the field, they're just kind of talking.
Mm-hmm.
The sky is amazing.
Oh, fancy. Yeah,
it gets a great, the thing looks incredible.
You got to have lights absolutely for the movie reasons. It just doesn't make any sense why he would build a field with lights on it. That's the thing. Although, you know, so that, as we talked about, they do have a little conversation where Ray Liotta is like, what's with the lights? And he says, all the stadiums have them now, even Wrigley Field, which I got me wondering, is Comiskey Park ever mentioned in the movie? I don't think so, but Wrigley Field is.
Yeah.
I don't think they ever mentioned that.
What's with the lights?
Oh, all the stadiums have them now, even Wrigley Field.
Makes it harder to see the ball.
Yeah, well, the owners found that more people could attend night games.
Owners.
In the book, the same thing comes up. So there's lights in the book. There has to be because of this.
Okay.
Because he says, what's with the lights? And in the book, apparently, he says, all the stadiums have them now except Wrigley Field. And, of course, this movie was filmed in the summer of 1988, which is the year that Wrigley got lights. So the line in the movie had to be, even Wrigley Field. And then Joe goes, makes it harder to see the ball. And he's like, well, the owners found that more people could attend night games. Owners. He goes, ah, fuck those Ricketts. It's amazing because they hadn't been by the team for like 30 years, but, well, 20. So he gets to meet Karen and Annie.
Mr. Jackson, this is my wife, Annie, and my daughter, Karen.
Ma'am? Hi.
Are you a ghost?
Karen? Just kidding.
It's okay. What do you think?
You look real to me.
Well, then I guess I'm real.
Would you like to come inside?
Thanks. I don't think I can.
And then he asks if he can come back and bring the other 7 banned White Sox. And, of course, Ray says, of course you can. I built this for you. And then on his way off the field, he turns, on his way to the corn.
Hey! Is this heaven?
No. It's Iowa.
Meaning it's the exact opposite.
That's what that means, yeah.
It's you're in hell.
Just we should also, confirmed. In addition to the batting thing, we should also touch on the fact that Shoeless Joe Jackson was from South Carolina.
Yeah.
Ray Liotta did absolutely nothing to put on any kind of a Southern accent or affect. And as you point out, 8 Men Out came out right around that same time. And D.B. Sweeney played Shoeless Joe Jackson. He was very much, you know, Southern guy, chewing tobacco. He brought all of that stuff with him. And I guess they were just like, nah, we don't need it. You don't need to have a Southern draw. It's fine. Just talk like you're from Brooklyn.
I guess the argument would be that in 8 Men Out, in order to give the, you know, because the theory in the movie is that Joe really didn't know what he was doing.
Right.
He has to be kind of a rube.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't have to be in this. He's just gets to be the iconic, you know. So I guess that's why. But yeah, you would think that, you know.
Well, particularly
if you could at least have the accent. You don't have to play him like he's a moron.
Right. Right. I mean, if he's literally spent a month with the USC baseball coach learning how to bat and throw a certain way, so it would be realistic. You would think that would have come in at some point. But yeah. And maybe they tried it and it didn't work. And they're like, eh, who knows? Just keep your normal voice. Who knows?
So anyway, so him and Annie are standing there and they watch Joe go in the corner and he disappears. And Ray goes, we're keeping this field. She goes, you bet your ass we are.
Bet your ass we are.
So then the next scene is
Gordon Whitmire.
Gordon Whitmire lookalike, Timothy Busfield, telling Ray that he and his partners can buy the farm from him for a fair price. It reminds him he never liked Iowa or farming. And he's like, I like Iowa. He's like, well, then why? How could you plow under your major crop? And he goes, what's a crop?
Funny. What's a crop?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
So Mark, which is Annie's brother, Timothy Busfield, gets very annoyed because while they're having this serious discussion about their finances and how those 2 acres are going to bankrupt them, Karen comes and whispers to her dad that she wants to go out and watch the baseball game. And Mark gets very upset because he thinks they're going to go watch TV.
Right.
But go outside and all 8 of the Sox are there.
Yes. Now, we've already talked about one thing that bothered me a little bit is there is a catcher there, guy coming out in catcher's gear. But the catcher for that team was Ray Shaw, who was not involved.
No. He was played by Medavoy, right? From from NYPD Blue.
Gordon Clapp.
Gordon Clapp. Stubby's brother.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they never identify the catcher.
They don't.
Other than the fact that they need somebody to catch because they're going to
Until later, there is a catcher identified.
Oh, well, yes, there is.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they don't. Right.
Another thing that bothered me was, so they pronounce 2 names different.
Yes.
Than an 8 Men Out.
Again, can we not get this right?
So Chick Gandel is the guy playing first. He's played by Art. What's Art's name? I can't think of Art's name. He also played Babe Ruth in The Sandlot.
Yeah.
And they call him Gandil.
Gandil.
And then Eddie Seacott is Knuckles.
Yep.
But they call him something that it took me a while to even realize that's who it was supposed to be. They didn't, because I think some people pronounce it Seacotti, but they don't, it's not even that. It's weird, but that really is Eddie Seacott.
It's Cheekot, or they call him something like that.
Yeah.
Throw the ball, Cheekot. Again, we can't. Because, those are, I think, 2 of the only players actually called out by name. 2 of the White Sox players.
Well, another guy, Buck Weaver.
Come on, asshole. Pitch.
Weaver. Nice.
Sorry, kid.
It's okay. I don't mind.
All right, Garrett.
Hey. So while they're sitting there, Mark and his wife and mother come out
indeed.
To say...
Do you know who the mother is, by the way? Sorry.
I recognize her from others. She's that lady.
Her name is Fern Persons. And Fern was the mother. She played Opal Fleener in Hoosiers. Mm.
Thank you. Mother, it's getting late. We better get going. Come on.
Sun don't shine on the same dog's ass every day, but, mister, you ain't seen a ray of light since you got here. I believe it's time we had a talk.
Sunday. Supper.
I accept.
So we kind of had a run here of these same actors doing back-to-back sort of classic sports movies, right? Amy Madigan, Gabby Hoffman. Well, that wasn't a sport. Uncle Buck was on sports. But great 80s movies. Fern Persons. Yes. And Fern is, she's not happy with Ray Kinsella either.
No. So they come out to say goodbye, and they clearly can't see the players.
Ray? Honey, Mom and everybody's leaving now.
Okay. Well, it was, thanks for coming.
Ray, think about what I said. You know, I'm just trying to help.
I know.
So I thought you 2 were going to watch some game.
Because it's not really a game. It's more like a practice.
Rusty?
See, there's only 8 of them, so they can't play a real game.
Eight of what?
Them.
Who them?
Them. Well, you don't see him?
Karen, honey, what are you watching?
The baseball man.
Baseball? Do you see the baseball man right now?
Of course I do.
But you really don't see him?
I don't think it's very polite to try to make other people feel stupid.
Yeah, that's it.
And they storm off.
Yes.
So he gets to go. He goes out on the field and he's yucking it up with the players. And Chuck Gandil tries to impress him, and that his uniform still fits.
Yeah.
And then he goes, "I died in 70. So it means I haven't had a cigarette in 18 years. You don't smoke, do you?" Clearly wants a cigarette. And then they make fun of Ray when Annie calls him to dinner.
That was great. Yeah. Ray, dinner. So he's one of the guys.
So he thinks everything's cool, and he turns and he starts to walk into the house, and he hears,
"What? I'm sorry, what? I didn't understand. What?
Ease his pain.
What the hell does that mean? Ease his pain. What pain? Right? Whose pain?
Ease his pain.
Ease his pain.
He's like, ah, fuck, the fucking voice is back again.
But right before that, as the guys are walking into the cornfields, one of them's like, I'm melting. Yeah, so now ease his pain.
But it's sunset. Another ironic thing, it's sunset, so the players are done.
Right.
You got lights. He put lights up just for you. Turn the fucking lights on.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's sunset. They're going to have, and they're getting ready to have dinner again. And then Annie reminds them that they have a PTA meeting after dinner. What time is the PTA meeting? 11 o'clock at night? So anyway, we see a PTA meeting, and the entire town has to be in this meeting. This
is packed. Yes,
packed. And they are talking about banning books.
Yes.
And Beulah Kesenick.
Beulah
is not having it. She's waving a Terrence Mann book around, and she wants it banned.
Mm-hmm. The boat rocker.
And then the guy, I don't know if he's the president of the school board or the principal, but he's like, he's trying to talk her down. Like, this is legitimate literature. Terrence Mann is a Pulitzer Prize winner and considered the finest satirist of his time.
He was in Men in Black, by the way, that actor.
Huh?
He also does a bunch of Mammoth movies, that actor, yeah. You should look up his name.
And you hear one of the guys yell, "Well, I think he's a prospect pervert and probably a communist, too." Well, maybe he would say prospect pervert, but I bet he would now.
Right.
"I think he's a pervert and probably a communist, too."
Mm-hmm.
But then Beulah, she's not giving it up.
"Mr. Harris, the so-called novels of Terrence Mann endorse promiscuity, godlessness, the mongrelization of the races, and disrespect to high-ranking officers of the United States Army. And that is why right-thinking school boards all across the country have been banning this man's S-H-I-T since 1969. You know why he stopped writing books? Because he masturbates."
Ooh.
And I thought, well, you know how we know that's not true? Because if masturbators couldn't write, there wouldn't be any books. So then apparently this was the first scene that they shot for this movie.
Okay.
And so Amy Madigan has this big speech, and she has to basically yell at everybody. And she was very, like, uncomfortable that the first scene in the movie was her yelling at a bunch of yelling at all the townspeople.
Right. Can understand that.
But she's throwing her 60s bona fides out.
"I cherished every one of his books, and I dearly wish he had written some more. And I think if you had experienced even a little bit of the 60s, you might feel the same way, too."
"I experienced the 60s.
No, I think you had 250s and moved right on into the 70s.
Ironic, saying someone who, at least her husband,
right,
thinks that he lived up the 60s in 4 months in California.
Yes.
Now, Ray is not paying attention, basically,
he's not.
This whole meeting. He's writing Ease His Pain and doodling all over the minutes or a newsletter. I don't know what
something,
it's supposed to be. And while he's missing, Beulah calls him a weirdo.
Yep.
And she calls him the biggest horse's ass in three counties, which, I mean, that seems like kind of an honor, actually.
But yeah.
Annie gets up and yells, "Who's with Eva Braun here? Who wants to ban books? Who wants to put on the Constitution? Who wants to spit on the Constitution of the United States?"
Yeah. I think she also says, "At least he's not a Nazi cow."
"Who thinks that we need to stand up the kind of censorship that they had under Stalin?"
Yeah.
And so it's kind of ironic that, you know, this scene 34 years ago would have been all right. This scene obviously makes the poor, these idiots in Iowa look like the biggest bunch of, when honestly, we're having these fucking meetings again.
All you got to do, country. If you replace the banning the books with the COVID vaccine, this scene holds up extraordinarily well.
The only thing that's different is if they had that meeting today, which they probably will, Beulah would be the governor of Iowa.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly.
So Ray figures out that he needs to ease Terrence Mann's pain.
Right.
And Annie is not buying it. She's like, he's my favorite writer too, but what's Terrence Mann got to do with baseball? And how do you prove it? You go to the library and you hit the microfiche.
That's what you got to do.
Now, I don't know what library that he would have gone to. He probably, I doubt they went all the way to Iowa City. It's a big university library.
Right.
My guess is it's either the University of Dubuque or Loras College, both of which are in Dubuque. Yeah, and I tried to figure it out. I couldn't find, I found stuff. Like, I know the school that they were in was like Western, it's an elementary school, Drexler Elementary in Farley, Iowa, which is six miles from Dyersville. They don't say where the library was. I'm guessing it was the University of Dubuque Library. It's about four stories high.
Okay.
It is not the one from Iowa City, and it's not the one at Iowa State.
Okay.
But anyway, so he gets to go through, he's doing his research, and he finds what he thinks is the tie-in. So he's telling Annie that he finds evidence that Terrence Mann was a huge baseball fan who dreamt of playing at Ebbets Field with Jackie Robinson. So now he's trying to convince Annie that he needs to go to Boston and find Terrence Mann and take him to a baseball game, take him to a Red Sox game.
Right.
She says he can't go because they're going broke, which I believe.
Yep, no doubt.
I get the money, the triple cost money, but he's a farmer. He's not getting any more money till October or November. So he might, if you just have him hitchhike. And he offers, he's not going to spend any money. He's going to sleep in the car.
Right. That'll be fun.
And honestly, other than going out in the field and digging up another corn plant and seeing if it still has roots, he doesn't have anything to do. He might as well go do it.
Right.
So what finally convinces her is that he's describing a dream that he had where he was at Fenway Park with Terrence Mann. He was keeping score. And she's like, is Fenway the one with the big green wall in left field? And he says yes. And she says she has the same dream.
Right.
So he's got to go.
So Ray drives to Boston.
So now this is interesting. I would not have figured this out. The scenes where, if you see him in the, of course he has a Volkswagen microbus. Of course he does. He's from the 60s.
Is it exactly?
They handed him out. You've got to drive one of those.
Right.
When you see him in the Volkswagen, it's very clear that he's in Boston. Although you don't really see Kevin very much. You can't really tell it's him, but you know that that's in Boston.
Right.
But when he gets out of the VW and he's walking around basically hassling people and trying to find Terrence Mann, it's very obvious when you watch and look for this, like that you see like a storefront and there's like a Red Sox poster hanging out. Mm-hmm. And then there's even like one of the signs is Boston something. Mm-hmm. And there's a Boston Globe mailbox, like very prominently placed. That stuff was all filmed in Galena, Illinois.
So was it, I knew Galena was the backdrop.
It's
for
also
Chisholm,
Minnesota.
Okay. So
you're right. That was Dubuque. They went to Dubuque was Boston. And only in that one scene where they had was the actual dialogue. Cause they did, obviously they did go. Because you see that they went to Fenway and, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon got to be in it. But they didn't film that scene. They filmed locally.
Okay.
They didn't film it there.
Yeah.
But it's funny when you see that it's very clearly they are putting things in it to try to reinforce. Hey, look, we're in Boston.
Hey, it's really Boston. There's a guy with a Red Sox hat.
But they're not.
Yeah.
Finally, he finds a guy who gives him a lead as to where Terrence is.
He goes
into this room, and there are no names on the mailboxes, but he sees that one of them has a business, and it's tie-dye software. And he's like, aha!
Right.
It's got to be a hippie. So it's going to be Mann's apartment, and it is.
Yep.
And this is a good scene the whole way through. This is he opens the door, and who the hell are you, and slams it in his face.
Right.
And he gets it open again, and Terrence says, I can't tell you the meaning of life, and I don't have answers for you. I don't give interviews, and I'm no longer a public figure. I just want to be left alone, so piss off.
Right. Should we tell folks who Terrence Mann is based on?
Oh, yes. it's based on, from the book, it was based on J.D. Salinger.
J.D. Salinger, right.
J.D. Salinger was not flattered by his portrayal in the book.
Right.
Didn't like it at all.
It was very litigious, evidently, in his later years, and evidently threatened the studio. If you make this, when he found out they were making the movie, if you make this movie and I show up in here, I'm going to sue you. So they basically changed that to Terrence Mann.
There are apparently people who thought that because of the all of the research that we see Ray doing about Terrence Mann and all the like clips they pull and they show that he was that was based on an actual, that there really was a Terrence Mann.
Yeah, it makes you have that thought for sure. Yeah,
and they said that the when Beulah holds up the book, the Boat Rocker,
mm-hmm.
to say that it should be banned, the design of the book is patterned on the first edition of Jack Kerouac's On the Road.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say, because the book, because clearly they're talking
about. I doubt
that
they probably decided JD's going to sue our ass, so we'll go with somebody else.
Yeah.
But they wanted it to look like an iconic book from that time period, so they.
Right. But clearly the book that they want to ban and all that is Catcher in the Rye, and which in Terrence's writing is called The Boat Rocker.
Yeah. Yeah, which comes up again. It's directly referenced.
Yes.
And maybe the funniest line in the whole movie.
Right.
So anyways, he gets slammed in his face again, and he persists again. He's trying to explain why he's there, and he's like, oh, you're from the 60s.
Yeah.
But finally he gets in the, he's going to give him a minute to talk.
Right.
And so he's still not having it, and he goes, you've changed. He's like, I suppose I have. Peace, love, dope.
Peace, love, dope.
He slams the door again. Oh, this is what happens. He slams the door again, but doesn't lock. It, like, bounces open. So Ray comes in with his hand shoved in his coat pocket.
Wow. You really pissed me off.
Okay, just hold it right there. I was hoping I wasn't going to have to do it this way.
What the hell is that?
It's a gun. What do you think it is?
It's your finger.
No, it's not. It's a gun.
Yeah, let me see it.
Get out of here. I'm not going to show you my gun. Now, look, I'm not going to hurt you. I just need you to come with me for a little while. And what are you doing?
I'm going to beat you with a crowbar, and then you go away.
Whoa, wait. You can't do that.
There are rules here? Oh, no, there are no rules here.
You're a pacifist.
Shit.
Hey, stop.
Right.
So anyway, Ray explains to him that he has to take him to that night's Red Sox A's game.
Mm-hmm.
And Terrence's like, you're going to kidnap me and take me to a baseball game. And he's like, yes. And finally Terrence is like, fine.
Right.
Then there's a good scene where they're walking through the concourse in Fenway Park, which has been in lots of movies, including like The Town. There's a whole robbery on there in The Town.
That's right.
And they're having this deep conversation, and Ray says to him, what do you want? And Terrence goes, I want them to start thinking for themselves. He's like, no, what do you want? And he like waves, and they're standing in front of the concession stand.
Right.
He goes, oh, a dog and a beer.
Yeah. There's three guys standing there with their arms folded. Like, not a big line, evidently, for the dog and a beer.
Okay, so now did you catch how much? Yes. The prices of the concession stand. Yes.
Yeah.
So 1988, when they filmed this, apparently, a Fenway Frank would have cost you $1.80.
Yeah.
A Polish sausage, a lot more, $2.25.
Oof.
Pretzels are $1.85. And then I found this odd. So the sponsor, the big sponsor, is Archway Cookies.
Yeah.
And you can buy a cookie for 85 cents. Like, who's going to the ballpark to get, like, when I think of Archway, I think of those molasses cookies.
Yeah.
You know, it's not buying me some peanuts and a molasses cookie, but that's what it was.
I remember two dogs and two beers, $7. I'm like, oh, you have not been to Wrigley Field in a while.
It's not that long ago.
It's not that long ago that it should be so much more expensive. Yeah. For two dogs and two beers, it'd be $40 or whatever.
I did not bother to go back and look because I'm sure you could figure out what game they're actually at. I'm sure it's easily attainable.
Yeah.
Which A's Red Sox game it is.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Rays keep it score just like he's supposed to, and we see number 24 line out to center, and then you hear,
go the distance. And the scoreboard, the big scoreboard next to the, under the Citgo sign out there, has Jose Canseco on it. And then he, over him, and then over some highlights, it says Archibald Moonlight Graham, Chisholm, Minnesota. And I forget what else. It's like one game played, no at-bats, or whatever.
Right.
And Terrence sees Ray kind of like confused and looking at him. And he's like, what's the matter? He's like, he didn't see that? And he goes, see what? He's like, oh, I'm sorry. I guess you didn't need to be here. Which pisses Terrence off because he's like, we can go now. He's like, I don't get to see the whole fucking game. You drag me to this game and I get to watch the whole thing.
Yeah, right, right. You're right. He's like, sorry, I guess you didn't need to be here.
So they back in the VW and they're heading to Terrence's apartment. And they have a little conversation.
I wish I had your passion, Ray. Misdirected though it might be, it is still a passion. I used to feel that way about things, but... You got another message, didn't you?
You think I'm crazy?
I already think you're crazy. What did it say?
Said the man's done enough. Leave him alone.
But, you know, of course, before then, as always happens in movies, you can be in the busiest street in America, but there's always a parking spot right up front where everybody pulls right in. And they have this car. And for some reason, and he gets out, they shake hands, so they're friends now. We know it was a good exchange. And we're not real sure why, but Ray decides to turn the van around.
Yeah, just a U-turn. You can't just go up and turn. Like,
no,
apparently,
can't do that.
Iowa is this way. And I got to go this way. I got to do a U-turn to get to Iowa.
You know, you could just turn right at the next block 50 feet ahead, Ray, and you'd be fine.
But as he does the U-turn, he has to slam on the brakes because Terrence Mann is standing right in his way.
Right, dramatically.
And he goes, Moonlight Graham. If you saw it, did you hear the voice too? Go the distance.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, do you know what it means? It means we're going to Minnesota to find Moonlight Graham.
Yeah.
So now they're on a road trip.
And he goes, so bitchin'. He says that at some point, if he's on the road, or yeah, we're going to go so bitching. Okay.
So
they're on the road to Chisholm.
She's talking. He's telling her that he's taken that Terrence Mann, and they're going to Minnesota, and they're going to go find this guy. And she says everything's great. You don't see her. You only hear her.
Right.
And after she hangs up, then they show the house, and Timothy Busfield and two schlubby-looking bankers are standing in her living room.
Right. And again, it's after dark. So why are they there late at night?
It's after. I mean, I guess we don't know if it's that first night. Maybe it could be real late. They went to the game, stayed for at least part of it.
Yeah.
Went back to Terrence's house, did a U-turn, drove partway to Minnesota, got to a hotel, and Timothy Busfield's still hanging out in his sister's house with his two bankers.
At one in the morning. At 1:30 a.m.
So now they get to Chisholm, Minnesota, and that is actually downtown Galena.
Right.
And I've been to Galena lots of times, and it's funny to see recognizable things in the background. Especially they really show it is picturesque. Galena is other than San Francisco, like the hilliest town in America. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And there are, in a couple of places, there's these big staircases that get you down from a street up above down to like shops and stuff. And they shoot a couple of them because they make for a nice background. That's the whole reason they're in the background. So they're trying to figure out how are they going to find Moonlight Graham. And Terrence is like, I know who to go see. And they go to the local newspaper.
Right.
Which is actually a pretty good idea. And then, of course, there's an old lady.
Yep.
Who says, oh, you mean Doc Graham.
Mm-hmm. He goes, Dr. Graham.
Yes.
Right.
And they're like, oh, okay. I said, well, we need to see him. Well, he's been dead since 1972.
Right.
So that's not great.
Yeah. 16 years ago.
But she walks them. She takes them back into the archives and tells them stories about Doc and shows them newspaper clippings. And she reads part of his obituary and how all the kids in Chisholm, if they needed medicine or they needed tickets to a ball game or whatever, those would miraculously appear in their pocket from courtesy of old Doc Graham. And he says something about it's a good writing. She wrote it. And he says, you're a good writer. And she tells him and says, you're a good writer too.
So are you. That was good. Yeah.
So that lady, some of the people in that are actually from Chisholm, Minnesota.
Oh, really?
They heard about, because Doc Graham is a real...
real guy, right.
And so they came down to Galena to be in some of the scenes. Like the people they interview, like they interview the guy in the bar. Which I think might be Dirty Gertz. He's like from Chisholm. So it's kind of neat that they, you know, they work them in. She's not one of them. She's an actress.
She is.
She died before the movie came out. It was her last movie.
Oh, no. Oh, jeez.
Didn't get to see that. One thing I noticed, though, while Terrence is like sitting there and he's reading these clips, he has his glasses off and he's using a magnifying glass to read the paper.
Yeah.
Like, maybe go get your prescription updated.
Right.
They go back to the hotel and this is funny. Ray is reading the paper and he laughs and he goes, "Did you know you're missing?"
Right.
And Terrence reads it and he's like, "Oh, I got to call my dad." So then Ray goes for a walk.
Yep.
And all of a sudden he's just walking through downtown Chisholm and he sees a reelect Nixon poster.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees the marquee on the movie theater says The Godfather, one of this year's best.
Yeah, this year's.
Now we see in the background, we see Burt Lancaster walking. You can't really tell it's Burt, but they have described Doc with his hat and his umbrella, took an umbrella everywhere, and you see him walking in the background. So then he sees him and he goes up and he calls him Moonlight. He says, "No one's called me that for a very long time."
Nobody's called him Moonlight Graham in 50 years.
Yeah. You know, he's out going for a walk and Ray asks if he can go with.
Mm-hmm.
So Doc tells the story of his one game in the big league.
"What do you want to talk to me about?"
"Well, when you got to the majors, you played only one inning of one game. What happened that inning?"
"It was the last day of the season. Bottom of the eighth inning, we were way ahead. I'd been up with the club about 3 weeks, but I hadn't seen any action. Suddenly, old John McGraw points a bony finger in my direction, and he says, 'Right field.'
Yes, sir.
I jumped up like I was sitting on a spring,
grabbed my glove, and ran out on the field."
"Did you get to make a play?"
"I never hit the ball out of the infield. Game ended, the season was over. I knew they sent me back down. I couldn't bear the thought of another year in the minors. So I decided to hang them up. Oh, sit down."
"Thank you. So what was that like?"
"It was like having this close to your dream. And then watch them brush past you like a stranger in a crowd. At the time, you don't think much of it. You know, we just don't recognize the most significant moments of our lives while they're happening. Back then, I thought, well, there'll be other days. I didn't realize that that was the only day. And now, Ray Kinsella, I want to ask you a question. What's so interesting about a half an inning that would make you come all the way from Iowa to talk to me about it 50 years after it happened?"
"I didn't really know till just now, but I think it's to ask you if you could do anything you wanted, if you could have a wish."
"And are you the kind of a man who could grant me that wish?"
"I don't know. I'm just asking."
"Well, you know, I never got to bat in the major leagues. I'd have liked to have that chance. Just once, to stare down a big league pitcher. To stare him down, and just as he goes into his windup, wink. Make him think you know something he doesn't. That's what I wish for. Chance to squint at a sky so blue that it hurts your eyes just to look at it. To feel the tingle in your arm as you connect with the ball. To run the bases, stretch a double into a triple, and flop face first into third. Wrap your arms around the bag. That's my wish, Rickensilla. That's my wish. And is there enough magic out there in the moonlight to make this dream come true?"
"What would you say if I said yes?"
"I think I'd actually believe you."
And Ray says there's a place he can go that he can do that. And Doc turns him down.
Yep.
So that's the end of that. And then the movie's over, and they... Oh.
That's it, yeah, right. Yeah, so he says, son, if I'd only gotten to be a doctor for 5 minutes, that'd have been the tragedy. Now I gotta get home. At least you'll think I got a girlfriend.
So Ray goes back to the hotel and tells Terrence right. that he met Doc somehow 16 right. years after he died, which Terrence is like...
He kind of skipped over the time travel part, didn't he?
Yeah.
I don't think he mentions, like, you know, I time traveled.
Yeah. By this point... Terrence is like, that makes perfect sense. Much sense as anyone else in this.
Fracking you. Right.
But he tells me, you got to call your wife.
Right.
And she explains that the bank sold the deed to her brother. Kind of a dick thing for the brother to do.
Pretty much dick thing. All over $600, as we pointed out painstakingly earlier. $600, all this financial direness.
So he tells her he can't come home, can't come straight home. He's got to take Terrence back to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
But Terrence says he wants to come to Iowa.
Right.
So the next morning they hop in the VW and they're driving and they see a hitchhiker. And he says something like, I need all the karma I can get or whatever. And he pulls over and this young lad with a bag and a baseball bat over his shoulder. I wouldn't pick up a guy with a baseball bat. I don't think it's a hitchhiker.
Right.
Hops in. They introduce themselves and he says, I'm Archie Graham.
Yeah. Well, first he goes, you're the first car. You're the first car that came by.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, we just appeared right before. Yes. And he's, I'm Archie Graham. And then we have the big moment of realization, and they realize they got moonlight as a youngster traveling in the car. Okay.
So Archie tells him that he hears there are towns all over the Midwest with teams, and they find people jobs during the day so they can play at nights and weekends. Mm-hmm. And then he falls asleep. Passed out in the van, and Ray and Terrence are talking, and Ray says, "You know, my dad did that for a while."
It's funny the way he described towns. You know, finding you a job so that you could play on their team. They haven't done that for years. My dad did that for a while, but that was in the 20s.
What happened to your father?
He never made it as a ball player, so he tried to get his son to make it for him. By the time I was 10, playing baseball got to be like eating vegetables or taking out the garbage. So when I was 14, I started to refuse. You believe that? American boy refusing to have a catch with his father?
Why 14?
That's when I read The Boat Rocker by Terrence Mann.
Oh, God.
Never played catch with him again.
You see, that's the kind of crap people always try to lay on me. It's not my fault you wouldn't play catch with your father.
I know.
Like, I know.
Which I think is the funniest movie. Funniest line. It's not my fault you wouldn't play catch with your father.
Right. And then we get to this awful thing that Ray tells his father.
What was that thing you said to your father?
I told him... I could never respect a man whose hero was a criminal.
Well, who was his hero?
Shoeless Joe.
You knew he wasn't a criminal. Why did you say that?
God, I was 17. Yeah, now, by the way, is that really that terrible?
No.
You know, you're a piece of shit drunk who doesn't support us. That would be kind of terrible. Yeah. I could never respect a man whose hero was a criminal?
Yeah. Especially
that doesn't sound all that.
When his crime was being banned from baseball? Like, not a crime you go to
It's not Manson.
Yeah, he says something like, because I was 17, son of a bitch died before I could take it back. And then Terrence says, this is your penance. Now I know everyone's purpose here, except mine.
Your penance for that horrible thing you said about... What? Okay.
So anyway, so they get to the farm, and Ray introduces Annie and Karen to Archie, and he says he's here to practice with the team. And that's when Annie says he's going to be able to do a lot more than that. And they shoot the field, and there's a bunch of guys out there. See all kinds of different uniforms.
Yep.
And Joe tells him, Ray, I hope you don't mind. We got tired of having just practices, so we brought another team out so we could play some real games. He's like, I don't mind. Where'd they come from? And Archie. First he goes, where'd they come from? You wouldn't believe how many guys wanted to come play. And Archie spots Smokey Joe Wood, Mel Ott, and Gil Hodges.
Gil Hodges, right.
Ty Cobb wanted to play. None of us could stand a son of a bitch when we were alive, so we told him to stick it.
and then he gives a great classic Ray Liotta laugh.
Basically it's basically the same laugh that he would give a year later in Goodfellas.
Exactly.
Why am I funny? You're just funny. Yeah, the way you say things, it's funny.
What? The way you tell the story and everything.
So this is when, so Archie, they basically, Joe's like, well, you came here to play, didn't you?
Yeah.
So Archie goes, puts on his uniform, and we see him walking up to taking a bat, and Eddie Cicotte, or Cicotte, or whatever.
Whatever they call him. Chicote, whatever.
He's pitching, and we know what's going to happen. Archie digs in, Eddie starts his wind-up, and Archie winks at him.
Mm-hmm.
And Eddie throws it at his head.
Right.
And Chick Gandil, or Gandil, whatever they say, call him, yells at him.
Oh! Watch it, boys! Hey! Hey!
Don't let him shake you up, Arch. Hang in there, buddy.
Hey, Knuckles, what are you throwing at the kid for?
He winked at me.
Don't wink, kid.
Yeah.
And then somebody yells, good thing for you he didn't throw a fastball. And Archie goes, let's see that fastball. And they're all like, oh no. He throws at him again.
Right.
So Archie pops up and goes, hey, ump, how about a warning? And the ump pulls his mask off and goes, sure thing, kid. Watch out you don't get killed.
Funny line.
This whole scene's pretty good because then Joe calls timeout and he's like waves right. Archie over to the chain link to talk to him.
Right, which, by the way, so Cicotte is pitching, and yet Joe's on the bench, so he's on the other team. Yeah. So they're clearly not playing, like, White Sox versus anybody else.
Time.
All right, those first two were high and tight. So what do you think the next one's going to be?
Well, either lone away or in my ear.
He's not going to want to load the bases, so look for low and away.
Right.
But watch out for in your ear.
Great line.
Yeah.
Yep.
So Archie hits the ball to center field. It's caught.
Yep.
Runner tags, scores from third.
Sacrifice fly.
He got to bat, but he didn't have an official at bat. His
right.
Unlike Adam Moonlight Greenberg, his official, his record remains unbesmirched.
Right.
Because instead of being 0 for 0 with a hit in the head, like Adam Greenberg was, Adam ended up 0 for 1. With a hit in the head, because he came back and got one at bat for the Marlins a few years later.
Okay, right, gotcha.
So then it's the next day, and we see Mark show up, and he's just walking across the field because he doesn't see any of the players. The pitcher almost hits him, and there guys
funny.
Are yelling at him.
Well, guys goes to try to rush him, and another guy tackles him.
And he starts arguing with Ray, and Terrence points, and he's like, he's pointing at the players like, he can't? And he's like,
yeah,
no. And he's like, well, then he's like, he points at Terrence Mann. He's like, well, who's, or if there's baseball players out there. And he points at, well, who's this? Elvis? he goes, that's Terrence Mann. And he shakes his hand and goes, okay, how do you do? I'm the Easter Bunny. So Mark tells Ray that he has no money, a stack of bills that could choke a pig, and come fall, no crop to sell.
Mm.
Well, except for all the corn that's growing on the either 198 or 298 acres that we can see all around him. Apparently, he just doesn't have 2 acres of a crop. He's got a crop.
Other than 99% of your farm, you have nothing to farm. Nothing. No, you have no yield.
But Mark does make him a fairly attractive offer.
Yes.
He's going to buy the farm.
Ooh.
And it's at $2,200 an acre. And he's going to let him live in the house for free.
What a guy.
Mm. I mean, obviously, you can't live on that forever, but...
Right.
But Karen stands up on the bleachers. She's eating a hot dog. She stands up on the bleachers and tells her dad that he doesn't need to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark and Ray yell and show, that's when he finds out it's $220 an acre, which that means the baseball field he's standing on is worth a whopping $4,400 worth of land.
Okay.
And Karen's like, Daddy, you don't need to sell the farm. And Mark's yelling at her. And Ray tells him to shut up and ask for her to explain, because you need this when you're having a serious discussion about your finances. You need the 6-year-old to weigh
to explain it, right?
And she goes, "People will come."
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, "What people?" It's like people from all over. They'll decide to take a vacation. They'll come to Iowa City. They'll think it's really boring, so they'll drive up and want to pay us, like buying a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark is like, "What the hell is she talking about?" And he hands Ray some paperwork. Apparently, like wants him to sign the agreement, whatever it is. And that's when Terrence stands up and gives the speech.
This famous
the reason James Earl Jones wanted to make the movie when he read it.
Right.
It's James Earl Jones, despite the fact he would later be in The Sandlot, and without looking it up, we think he was in Bingo Long of Traveling All-Stars, did not like baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Had no interest in being in the movie until he's like, oh, I want to give the speech, and even joked with his wife, I'll make the movie, and they'll cut this speech.
Right.
Ray, people will come, Ray. They'll come to Iowa for reasons they can't even fathom. They'll turn up your driveway, not knowing for sure why they're doing it. They'll arrive at your door, as innocent as children, longing for the past. Of course, we won't mind if you look around, you'll say. It's only $20 per person. They'll pass over the money without even thinking about it. For it is money they have, and peace they like.
Ray, just sign the papers.
And they'll walk out to the bleachers. Sit in shirt sleeves on a perfect afternoon. They'll find they have reserved seats somewhere along one of the baselines, where they sat when they were children and cheered their heroes. And they'll watch the game, and it'll be as if they dipped themselves in magic waters. The memories will be so thick, they'll have to brush them away from their faces.
Ray, when the bank opens in the morning, they'll foreclose.
People will come, Ray.
You're broke, Ray. You sell now or you lose everything.
The one constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball. America has rolled by like an army of steamrollers. It's been erased like a blackboard, rebuilt and erased again. But baseball has marked the time. This field, this game, is a part of our past, Ray. It reminds us of all that once was good, and it could be again. Oh, people will come, Ray. People will most definitely come.
Ray says again, I'm not signing.
Right.
Karen's standing there eating a hot dog, and Mark grabs her for some reason.
Which does not hold up too well.
She falls off the bleachers, and she's out cold. Just
right. I mean, she falls. Probably, it's like 10 feet, it looks like. It's especially pretty good fall.
She's 6 years old. She's probably dead.
It's a big fall, yeah.
So Annie runs to call an ambulance, and Ray tells her to wait.
Yeah, wait!
Yeah, wait, you don't need to.
Yeah. Okay.
And they look over, and Archie is walking towards the thing. Now, it's been established earlier, where they invited, on the night they first met, she was Joe. She invited him up to the house, and he looks down. There's like a gravel strip.
Right.
That separates the field even from like the seats, and he clearly can't cross it.
Right.
And so Archie stops and he looks down. And
again, meanwhile, Andy could be calling for help.
Yes.
Because they're a little calm.
You could do both.
You could do both.
It's rural Iowa. It's going to take 20 minutes for the ambulance to show up.
Easily. Yeah. It's not going to be there for an hour anyway. Yeah. Maybe go call, and we'll see if Frank Whaley turns into Burt Lancaster. But he's kind of betting it all that's going to happen.
So Archie has stopped at the gravel, and Ray realizes that Archie can't walk past. And Archie drops his glove and takes a step across the gravel, and he turns into Doc Graham. Frank Whaley becomes Burt Lancaster, and Mark sees him.
Right.
And he goes, this child's choking to death. And he whacks her on the back, and hot dog flies out.
By the way, I guess there was no Heimlich maneuver back in 1980. He does the pats her on the back.
Yeah.
Gets it out.
Ray thanks the doc, who thanks him. And then he realizes that Doc can't go back.
Right.
And he goes, it's all right. Best be getting home before Alicia thinks I have a girlfriend. So call back to the...
Yep. Yeah,
he walks through the play. He walks through the players, and they all shake his hand.
Like, way to go, Doc!
And Joe stops him.
Hey, rookie! You were good.
Yeah.
And then that's when Mark. He's seen Doc, and now he looks around and says, when did these ball players get here?
Do not sell this farm, Ray. You gotta keep this farm.
Mark, you've had a very rough day. Why don't you go inside and get something cold to drink?
Yeah, thanks for hanging on. Anyway, as Bert walks off, he goes, win one for me one day, will you, boys? That's all very touching. Do not sell this farm, Ray. So the players leave, and Shoeless Joe shouts out, do you want to come with us? And Ray thinks, he's talking to him. He's like, yeah, I want to come. But he's not.
No, and he gets pissed.
Ooh, because he's talking to Terrence. He's inviting Terrence Mann, not Ray, to come out.
Hey, do you want to come with us?
You mean it?
No, not you. Him.
Him?
Come with you?
Out there.
What is out there?
Come and find out.
Wait a second. Why him? I built this field. You wouldn't be here,
Ray,
if it weren't for me.
God's
well,
sake.
You wouldn't be here
I'm
for what?
I'm on a test. You have a family.
I know, but I want to know what's out there. I want to see it.
But you're not invited.
Not invited? What do you mean I'm not invited? That's my corn out there. You guys are guests in my corn.
Ray.
No, wait. I have done everything I've been asked to do. I didn't understand it, but I've done it. And I haven't once asked what's in it for me.
What are you saying, Ray?
I'm saying, what's in it for me?
Is that why you did this? For you?
Is that why you did all this? For you? Now, I think a reasonable response would be like, yeah, well, kinda.
Yeah.
I kinda want something out of this. Yeah. You know?
So Terrence admits that he gave the interview about Ebbets Field, which he had denied.
Right.
To Ray when he was in his apartment. He goes, he's going to go see what's out there and write about it. So he says, I want a full description. And Terrence says, take care of this family. And he heads for the corn. And it's kind of funny how, like, he literally stands there, he, like, sticks his arm in and pulls it back out. He, like, starts to walk in and he stops.
That's how you do it, right? What the hell is this?
Yeah. And then he finally walks in and we see him disappear.
Right.
So then Annie and Ray... I've turned around and they're heading back to the house, and Joe is just standing there grinning at them.
Mm-hmm.
What? What are you grinning at, you ghost?
If you build it, he will come.
This pain.
Go the distance.
It was you.
No, Ray. It was you.
So there's a nice moment where, because his dad was an old man and died. He died after the wedding, but he says in the thing that he never met Annie. Obviously, he never met Karen.
Mm-hmm.
So he introduces John to Annie and to Karen. And John's looking around, and he's like, can I ask you something? Is this heaven? No, it's still Iowa.
Still Iowa, yeah.
Iowa? I could have sworn it was heaven.
Catch a good game.
Thank you. So beautiful here.
For me.
Well, for me, it's like a dream come true. Can I ask you something? Is this heaven?
It's Iowa.
Iowa?
sworn it was heaven.
Is there a heaven?
Oh, yeah. It's the place dreams come true.
Maybe this is heaven, yeah.
And then the most controversial part of the movie. This is people will argue this forever, and I feel like it's already been solved in dialogue previously in the movie.
Okay.
Good night, Ray. Good night, John.
Hey, Dad? You want to have a catch?
I'd like that.
Ray says, "Hey, Dad, want to have a catch?"
Oh, right.
And as we know, it's play catch. It's not have a catch. And we know this because earlier, Terrence had yelled at him.
That's when I read The Boat Rocker by Terrence Mann.
Oh, God.
Never played catch with him again.
You see, that's the kind of crap people always have to lay on me. It's not my fault you wouldn't play catch with your father.
I know.
Your father. Yep, not my fault you wouldn't play catch with your father.
Right.
But they decide to have a catch.
Have a catch.
And that's when we see Dwyer Brown, not the best thrower in the world. But
right, that's right. Fine. And that's the first time that it's revealed that it's the first time he calls him Dad. Yes. So now,
hey, Dad, want to have a catch?
And everybody kind of knows, like, you know, John knows he's his dad. Ray knows he's dad. It's all, yeah.
So we see him playing catch, and then the camera is obviously at some point switches to in a plane because it's, you know, maybe they had a helicopter in 1988. And you get this overhead shot of them still playing catch, but then you see this long line of headlights.
Mm-hmm.
And basically they had to do two things. They put out a call to everybody in Dyersville and the surrounding area to come be in the movie.
Come on out.
Sitting in your car and leaving the headlights on. Oh. And not only that, but the farms that were on either side of the road, they had to shut off any light so that it would it would stand out more. And they said that in order to give the illusion there was a little movement, they were coordinating them turning their brights on and off.
Okay.
So that it would kind of flicker on the
right.
So, but you get that it's an iconic shot. When you think of Field of Dreams, one of the things you think of is that, I mean, it goes for miles, that line of cars.
They're all lined up to come see Frank Schwindel.
If they did it today, they'd throw a drone up at night,
yeah,
and then some poor sap in a VFX suite would sit there and have to like draw in these things that look like headlights. But back then, they actually did it practically.
Real cars, yep.
And that's it. That's the end of the movie. So you're right. It's an economical hour 47, like what, hour 37 without credits?
Right. Hour 45 total runtime, and that includes credits, obviously. So yeah, they get through it.
Yeah. So facts about the movie. There was an actual Archibald Moonlight Graham.
Yep.
And the people Terrence is interviewing in the bar were people who knew the real Doc Graham. They found out about the movie and the inclusion of Doc's character, drove from Chisholm to Iowa, and the stories the men shared were actual stories about Doc.
Because Doc actually practiced medicine in Chisholm.
Yes.
That actually happened.
He was a real baseball player on June 29th, 1905. He played one game with the Giants. Following the game, he continued playing professionally until 08, mostly in the New York State League, until retiring at the age of 30.
Mm-hmm.
We told a story about Ben and Matt.
You know, one thing that is not answered, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but one of the connections that is made in the film is that Terrence Mann wrote a character named John Kinsella that was based on Ray's dad. But that's never explained. Like, why did you write? Was it a coincidence? Was it a real? Was it purposeful? That's never. Do we know anything about that?
How about this?
Okay.
So in the novel, which was actually, well, I'll get to what the name of the novel was, because it's in the novel that this is based on.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of seeking fictional author Terrence Mann, Ray Kinsella seeks real-life 60s author J.D. Salinger. In 1947, right. Salinger wrote a movie called A Young Girl in 1941 with no waste at all. Featured a character named Ray Kinsella. And his most famous work, the novel The Catcher in the Rye, one of Holden Caulfield's classmates, is Richard Kinsella.
Okay.
In the original novel, Ray has a twin brother named Richard, which was dumped in the movie.
Okay.
So the Kinsella thing, actually, it's from the original thing that it's based on.
Okay.
So the movie, after the movie was completed, test audiences didn't like the original title. Do you know what the original title was?
Was it just Shoeless Joe?
It was just Shoeless.
Shoeless?
Shoeless.
That's really stupid.
They said it's okay. Not like a movie about a bum or a hobo. Universal called director screenwriter Phil Alden Robinson to tell him that Shoeless Joe, well, no, it must have been Shoeless Joe. I don't know why it
didn't say Shoeless Joe.
The first part.
It wouldn't make any sense. Yeah.
It didn't work, and the studio changed the title of the film to Field of Dreams. When Robinson heard the news of the change, he called W.P. Kinsella, the author, and told him the bad news. But apparently, W.P. didn't care, saying that Shoeless Joe was the title the publishing company gave the book. Kinsella's original title was Dream Field.
Oh, there you go.
So Field of Dreams is actually better than
Pretty close, Dream Field. Yeah.
Amy Madigan was a hit in Dubuque. She was offered a job as a bartender during filming. The owner didn't know she was an actress.
That's funny.
During filming, Iowa was in the middle of a drought, and the cornfield surrounding the diamond had to be given lots of extra water in order to grow tall enough for the actress to disappear into the stalks. As a result, the corn grew too fast for the Costner shots. When the corn is above his shoulders early in the movie, he is walking on an elevated plank.
Oh, really?
It was actually too good.
Yeah. Again, thrilling the townspeople, I'm sure.
Yes. Yeah, during a lunch with the Iowa Chamber of Commerce, Phil Alden Robinson broached his idea of the final scene in which headlights could be seen for miles along the horizon. Chamber folks replied it could be done, and the shooting of the final scene became a community event. The film crew was hidden on the farm to make sure aerial shots did not reveal them. Dyersville was then blacked out, and local extras drove their vehicles to the field in order to give the illusion of movement. Drivers instructed to continuously switch between their low and high beams. Thousands of pallets of green grass were brought in to make the baseball field, but due to the haste in planning because of the shooting schedule, the grass was not able to grow appropriately and died.
Mm.
Now, this is good. This is, I'm sure they just called up the Bears because they said in order to keep the grass green, the production crew painted the grass.
Oh, nice.
Been doing that at Soldier Field for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Story depended on the farm having row after row of high corn, but when shooting was set to begin, the crop was stunted due to the worst drought in Iowa since the Dust Bowl. 3 weeks before shooting was scheduled for the fields, the company spent $25,000 to truck in water from the Mississippi to help the corn grow. That's pissed off the neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
As a hedge against that possibly failing, production designer Dennis Gassner ordered 50,000 silk corn stocks from South Korea. But it turned out to be not necessary as the crop began to grow in time.
Huh.
Charles Gordon later related how the production and farm owner became unpopular among the locals whose own crops were suffering in the drought.
I bet.
James Earl Jones decided to do the film after his wife read the script and became mesmerized by People Will Come speech. Both joked they had concerns the scene would be cut from the film. Don Lansing, the owner of the property chosen, agreed to let production reconfigure his house and open it up inside to accommodate cameras and equipment. He was paid $12,000 for his consent, plus an air conditioning system was installed, the porch was built, and floors were leveled. And by leveled, they don't mean destroyed. They mean it's a rickety old farmhouse, and he finally had level floors in it again.
That's a pretty good deal.
Now, I wondered, because when you watch it, there's a scene where I believe it's the scene where he's telling her he needs to go to Boston, and she's telling him they can't afford it. They walk up the stairs in the middle of the house, and the upstairs is just their bedroom. Like, there's no door. They literally walk up into the middle of it. And I'm like, there's no farmhouse in the world that's built like that. Well, apparently that would have been as a result of them, you know, opening things up.
Ah, okay.
Cameras and stuff. Because at one point, you see him put Karen to bed in her room. She's got a door.
Mm-hmm. Right.
On the first floor.
Huh. Okay.
Steve Easton's character, Eddie Seacott, or Scotty, or whatever, is the pitcher who almost hits Archie Graham at the plate. Coincidentally, it was Seacott who plunked the first batter of the 1919 World Series as a signal to the gamblers that the fix was in.
So perhaps not so coincident.
Yes.
Coincidentally.
According to Phil Alden Robinson, Kevin Costner was the studio's first choice to play Ray, but having just starred in Bull Durham the year before.
Wow, it was that close. Okay.
1988, 1989. They didn't think he'd want to be in a second straight baseball movie. Ultimately, one studio executive slipped the script to Costner, who immediately expressed interest in the film.
Nice.
Okay. The voice is credited simply as himself, and the himself. Identity of the actor who provided it remains unknown.
Mm-hmm.
W.P. Kinsella has a theory about who he thinks the voice was. Who do you think the voice was?
Well, the theory that I've read, and even though it sounds nothing like him, is Ed Harris.
Amy Madigan's husband.
Yes.
So that would have been. That's who W.P. Kinsella thinks it was. Others have speculated it's Ray Liotta, Timothy Busfield, or Kevin Costner. Nobody seems to think
why is that? Well, such a mystery about who the voice is.
While waiting for Kevin to express interest, one other famous actor was approached about playing Ray Kinsella. Do you know who it was? He'd also, let's see, he either was just making a baseball movie or, I gotta see the year of this.
This is 1988. Yeah. Just making a baseball movie.
There, he would make a baseball movie 3 years later. So he had never been in one.
Never been in one. What's got to be?
Although he did have a famous baseball-esque scene in one of his finest movies that he's ever made, where he immortally screamed, "The Cleveland wins the pennant."
See, well, it's got to be obviously a big star. If it's
a big star, it's about 1988-89. It's about the biggest. At the time, he was really hitting his. Yeah. Still active today.
It's not Tom Cruise.
Nope, close.
Huh? Who is it?
Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks. Okay. Yes. So he had not made A League of Their Own yet.
Nope. He'd make that a couple years later.
Yeah, threw me off. I didn't think that was that. I didn't think that was so much later. Okay. Yeah.
And the Cleveland Wins the Pennant was the great tennis scene in Bachelor Party.
Oh, playing, that's right.
Him and Tawny Kitaen are playing doubles with her parents, and he keeps hitting the ball out of the thing. And then you see the neighbor. Right. One of these days, I'm going to kick that son of a bitch's ass.
Yeah. Nice.
Okay, W.P. Kinsella, the author of the original novel, reviewed the movie for a Canadian periodical. He gave it 4 stars out of 5.
Ooh.
For two reasons.
Okay.
He didn't think the character of Mark was villainous enough.
Okay.
And he didn't think Gabby Hoffman looked like she could be Kevin Costner and Amy Madigan's kid.
I wanted to say that's a stupid reason.
It's a very stupid thing.
Okay.
When Ray's in the feed store and talks to a fellow farmer about hearing voices, there is a song you could hear in the background.
Mm.
It's Crazy by Patsy Cline.
Oh, that's right. I remember that now that I've seen it. Yeah. Which that Ross Perot would famously use.
How many Wyatt Earps are in the movie?
How many Wyatt Earps?
How many Wyatt Earps?
What the hell is a Wyatt Earp?
Who's Wyatt Earp? How many Wyatt Earps?
How many Wyatt Earps? 7.
2. Kevin Costner and Burt Lancaster.
Wyatt Earp.
Wyatt Earp.
I thought you were, okay. There was like some Easter egg or something. Oh, it wasn't, I didn't know.
Obviously, Kevin played Wyatt Earp.
Actor played Wyatt Earp.
Burt Lancaster played him in 1957 in Gunfight at the OK Corral.
Yeah.
Amy Madigan and Gabby Hoffman worked together two movies that year, Uncle Buck and Field of Dreams.
Yeah.
In Field of Dreams, Amy plays her mother and Uncle Buck. Gabby's mother is different, but Amy plays the girlfriend.
The girlfriend of John Candy.
Other actresses who were considered to play Karen.
Mm.
Not Karen. Annie. To play Annie. Amy Madigan's character.
Okay.
Karen Allen.
Okay. Good
Kim
one.
Basinger. Can't see that.
Okay.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Barbara Hershey got to be in the consideration. No, okay.
Gina Davis.
Oh, yeah.
Jodie Foster.
Jodie Foster, interesting.
Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio.
Okay.
Demi Moore.
Hmm.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yep.
Meg Ryan, Molly Ringwald, Rene Russo, Emma Thompson.
Emma Thompson? Interesting. All
Ally
the biggie.
Fee, Madeline yep. Stowe, or Susan Sarandon.
Huh.
So the year after, there's no way. How are you supposed
there's
to
a way
do
they
that?
There's no way. Yeah.
Now, I wonder, I think the list is probably bullshit, because there's a huge list here for Ray, and we know that basically they just wanted Kevin.
Yeah.
But here's what they listed. Now, there's one guy. Actually, I'll ask you this. Kevin Costner obviously is great in it. I can think of one guy who would have been every bit as good and has a baseball background.
Okay. Is he on this list?
He is on the list. He was one of the guys that they apparently considered.
Okay. Pete LeCocq.
Kurt Russell.
Oh, Kurt Russell. I don't think he'd be as good as Kevin. I like Kurt.
I can see him. I can see him playing the guy who the corn talked to him. And he'd be obviously be believable in the baseball scenes, considering he was a professional baseball player.
Right.
So the guys on the list, that list is bullshit. It's like every actor. Of course, the actress list.
There was a big actor in 1988, I'm sure, yeah.
Alec Baldwin. Jeff Bridges.
Yep.
Tom Cruise.
Yep.
Michael Douglas. Richard Dreyfuss. Just play your Close Encounters. Just be crazy again. Maybe you can make a baseball out of mashed potatoes. Harrison
just
Ford.
The biggest stars. Yeah, they're just going through the biggest stars.
Richard
of the time.
Gere.
Yeah.
Mel Gibson. Ed Harris. William Hurt. There's one I hear that made me laugh when I heard. Tommy Lee Jones. Michael Keaton. I could see Michael Keaton.
Yeah, that I could see.
Christopher Lambert, because you need the Highlander. Michael Nuri. Dennis Quaid.
Okay.
Kurt Russell, Patrick Swayze, Bruce Willis, and how about this? You could have had Emma Thompson and Gary Oldman. Wouldn't that have made for a great...
that would have been great.
All right, who should Trey Wilson have played?
You know, it wouldn't be... It would be very small roles, but maybe he would have made him bigger. I would have to say he'd either have to be Chaikat or Gandil.
I think he would have made a great Mark.
Yeah, you're going to say Timothy Busfield. Yeah.
He could have just been chewing Ray's ass about what a terrible farmer he is, and how his sister and his niece are going to be homeless because you're a shiftless farmer.
He would have definitely been more villainous, satisfying J.P. Kinsella.
All right, so who would you have played in the movie?
I'm gonna go with Chaikat.
All right,
small role.
I would have been Shoeless Joe, because unlike Ray Liotta, I bat left-handed and throw right-handed.
Oh,
I would not have had to have faked any of it.
Okay.
And I know from slinging the ball around on that field that I would have looked great.
See, there you go.
Doing it.
There you go. All right, so now this leads up to the big game.
We don't have any other standing questions, do we? I think that's our two. Who would you be, and what would Trey Wilson be?
And now we can all look forward to the real game. Just on what day is that?
Thursday
the 11th? Thursday the 11th, okay.
Yeah, August 11th. Hopefully I will get this edited and up in time for people. Actually, people probably just listen to this while you're watching the game. You won't miss anything.
Yeah.
You'll still get to see the corn, and it'll be pretty. I kind of wonder, I would be up for if the Reds and Cubs decided simply to stage a production of League of Their Own instead of playing.
I would do that.
Because they'd be just as competent at that as they are with actually trying to play baseball these days.
Yeah, of 8 Men Out, you mean. Yeah.
Yeah,
I did a production of 8 Men Out many, many years ago. We should just do that.
Who did you play in 8 Men Out?
I was Studs Terkel's character.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Very nice.
They should just do that. That would be better.
I'll call Crane.
Get Crane on the phone. Yeah.
All right.
Well,
there you have it.
Hopefully everyone enjoying that. Field of Dreams. Here we go.
Many of us have herpes.